Welcome to the America's Jobs Team podcast. Every week, we dive deep with economic development professionals on leadership and other issues challenging our industry. Our goal is to equip listeners with the knowledge to grow their impact and influence. You are America's Jobs Team, and when you get stronger, communities thrive.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the America's Jobs Team. I'm Carla Stones, and I'm excited to be with Lanier Richardson today. And I think as you learn throughout the interview today, you're going to hear his background in economic development is really, really fascinating. I was reading through his bio myself. I'm excited to hear what he has to say and his thoughts on what's happening in the world, especially it relates to economic development. So I'm not going to talk much more. I'm going to turn it over to him in a second. But Lanier, I think we need to start with how you ended up at Rutgers doing the role that you're in and what it has to do with economic development and just kind of your career pathway to get to where you are.
Yeah, very briefly. First, I'm happy to be with you today. I started my career as a bank lawyer. It was in a law department with 90 lawyers. We, you know, work on transactions, making a $100 million loan to some big corporations. Every day about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I start to fall asleep on the loan document. It wasn't until I had an opportunity to do a pro bono assignment for the bank, which was loaning $100,000 to a local barber who was buying his building. It was at that point that the work came alive for me. It was the same mortgage and promissory note, but instead of making a $100 million loan to a public utility or some publicly traded company, something about this community development work inspired me. Fast forward now, that's 30 years ago. What I remember, I couldn't articulate it succinctly now, then as I can now, getting resources to people and places that other people overlook or undervalue, that's my passion. And so my career has been all of that. I started, left the bank shortly thereafter. I started building homes on, you know, ethnic, urban, and underserved areas. As an entrepreneur, I got an opportunity to work with a large publicly traded company, getting retail to underserved areas. But really in 2007-08, when the recession hit, I moved to Newark, New Jersey, and I headed the Economic Development Corporation when Cory Booker was mayor. And coming out of the recession, Mayor Booker was such a, you know, charismatic leader. The city was strategically placed and had, you know, economic assets that we could articulate. And we got $2 billion of new development, office towers, grocery stores, hotels, residential. And when Cory Booker, instead of being Mayor Booker, became Senator Booker, is when I moved over to Rutgers Business School. I run the Rutgers Center for Urban Entrepreneurship and Economic Development. It really is the university's, you know, outreach center. We open the doors, we make space, equipment, and resources available to entrepreneurs, and we make the connection between entrepreneurship and economic development, entrepreneurship and community revitalization. I'm fortunate. Rutgers is such a great place. Our dean has made the school having social impact a strategic priority, and our chancellor really is a national or really international sort of champion for publicly engaged scholarship. So I'm having a ball. I get to open the doors of the university. Rutgers is, you know, Big Ten, very important state university. And, you know, universities as anchors and as, you know, key actors in economic development is well established in our field.
Yeah, well, I can tell just from talking to you already that you are a ball of energy and so passionate about what you're doing, which is really, really exciting. And I, you know, when you were talking about really feeling called to getting resources to people and places that are often overlooked or underserved, I could kind of feel like all of your passion just radiating through your being. Yes. And I also know that this year has been an incredibly hard time for a lot of those people and a lot of those places for a multitude of reasons. And it's not just, you know, the systemic racism that was just, you know, really brought to light again this year in a really, really gut-wrenching way.
Sure.
But also just COVID and the impact that it also has had on people and places that now are in an economic situation that is just kind of compounding what was already happening. So what, you know, you're focusing on this every day and you're very, very passionate about these people and these places. What is the biggest challenge that you're seeing for these groups, especially like the entrepreneurs and the small businesses that are, you know, focused on, you know, they're either minority owned or they're focused on places that are economically already experiencing some hardships? What's those challenges and what's your advice for people, those individuals, and maybe even the economic developers that are hoping to impact those individuals and communities?
Yeah, this is a period of pandemic, of protest, and political pandemonium, is how I think about it. And what is also a moment or a movement, hopefully, where talking about inclusive economic development and inclusive economic growth can be done without apology. Talking about systems change and asking the tough questions about what have we always done that we should do differently as a result of the moment, bringing to light the systemic inequalities, you know, in our economies, right? That's work that I'm very passionate about. I do, you know, I consult with a lot of foundations, you know, that are investing resources and trying to figure out how do we drive inclusive economic development, inclusive growth. And I talk about it as sort of two things. I joke as alliteration. I like alliteration. So one I say is the narrative and the numbers. The others I think about it as vehicles and vessels.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then finally is data, is deal making, and is dollars. So those are my three. So let me just talk about them. So
yeah.
The narrative and the numbers, right? So right now is very clear, really minority owned, Black specifically, entrepreneurs, and small business owners in general are very adversely impacted by the shutdown orders as a result of the pandemic. And so targeted programming, both helping with PPE, helping with strategic advisory services and technical assistance, and ultimately capital grants and or loans, absolutely necessary and continue to be so. We're not out of the woods yet. Many of our small business owners are, you know, specifically struggling. And, you know, we've done some research at Rutgers specific to Black entrepreneurs that show they have less capital, less reserves, just ability to be able to maneuver and pivot and survive. It's, you know, it's a lot of work we're doing. Creating strategies to help Black entrepreneurs survive and thrive is a lot of work that we're doing at Rutgers and in our advisory practice. So we're telling the stories. People now know the narrative, right? But also communicating about the numbers that, you know, what does it mean when you say they're struggling? How many days, you know, the average Black-owned business has something like 8 days of consumer-facing Black-owned business, 8 days of cash flow, right? The income inequality gaps that have been well-defined. The difference between, you know, a white-owned entrepreneur and a Black-owned entrepreneur, you know, in the U.S., you know, 10 times in terms of accumulated wealth, right? So those numbers and really being able to focus in there is something that's strategically important. You know, when I talk about, vehicles and vessels. So now we've had these macro announcements. I'm keeping a chart. In the U.S., the Fortune 100, large corporations have made over now $60 billion of commitment to racial justice investors, to small business support, to Black entrepreneur, you know, and investment funds, right? But there's still this disconnect because the question is, where's the vehicle? So there's the big announcement on one end, there's a pool of entrepreneurs on the other end and communities needing resources. What's needed now in between there are vehicles and vessels. Vehicles that I think of as investment ready or transactions that can be structured so as that can accept the capital and really defining that capital. Is it a grant money? Is it sponsorship? Is it impact investment? Is it market rate investment? Right. So understanding that and getting it into the right vehicle. or vessels. Sometimes it really is philanthropy. And is it nonprofit organizations? Is it economic development corporations? Is it funds of funds that are investing? This capital is something that is needed now. And then finally, you know, data, deal making, and knowledge, right? This being able to understand the trends, to have some focus on how things are changing, you know, a lot of surveying, a lot of just sort of reading changes and getting opinions is something that I know I spend a lot of my day on. Mm-hmm. And the deal making is that being this bridge between entrepreneurs and bankers and philanthropy, you know, it takes relationships to be able to do deals. And then finally, the dollars. Again, I start with money and I end with money. It needs capital, right? To fuel ideas, to invest in inclusive innovation, grants to keep people open. And it is an investment. Is it sponsorship? You know, that all of that is important right now and really amplified by just all the things that are happening in our world right now.
So, you know, I've already wrote so many notes. Because you're talking about things that are near and dear to my heart as well. And I'm sitting here thinking of all the ways that economic developers can play a role, not just in the vehicles and vessels pieces, but also in making sure that that relationship and that connectivity is there so that when funding is available and support is available, that we can actually connect those people to the community. And I know from the work that Consultant Connect has done with a lot of economic development groups, one of the things that has been on their mind, and it's not an easy question to ask, but I'm just going to ask it, is that they're sometimes feeling like they wish that there was a better way to network and to gain a little bit more trust or a little bit more access to the minority community. In fact, they don't even know all of the businesses that are out there that they probably could have been helping all along. And now that there's funding made available, they really need to find them. So is there any advice that you might have on how to better get connected? How to really, I think some of them are feeling like maybe it seems like disingenuous at this point,
right,
that they weren't reaching out, and now that the situation is what it is, that they are. What advice do you have for economic developers want to get involved?
My advice is you are needed now. Your expertise, laser focused on these issues, can have impact. So it should be a message of empowerment. To do so, it takes intentionality. And people talk about being intentional, but I am going to find a way to bridge the gap, right? How? Trusted advisors, trusted, community partners. It starts with if you said, hey, I'm trying to figure out how to connect with minority partners, I'm sure there's someone in the community or there are folks, you know, advisors like me will say, well, here's how you do it, right? But in short, every community has some Black or minority professional organization. Black accountants, Black MBAs, Black Lawyers Associate. There's social organizations, fraternities, sororities, church-based groups. There's typically an African-American or Latino Chamber of Commerce, right? Mm-hmm. Some of this is all result of, there's an African-American Realtors Association, doctor's practice. Typically, it all resulted out of systemic inequality and racism, you know, years ago. But these organizations are still there, and they can tap in. It's a place where you can tap in and say, we have resources. We want to figure out how to design programming that will get those resources and will give people a better chance of surviving and recovering and thriving. Black engineering, Black accountants, Hispanic engineers, Hispanic accountants. They're all of these, and that's where I would start, right? It's, can I find a trusted advisor, a partner that will be a translator, not be afraid to sort of say, hey, truth to power, that's not working, that's a bad idea, or here's how you communicate it in a way that's not condescending or offensive in some way, but, and also here's what the resource really, part of the challenge right now is really understanding unfiltered what the resource is, what resources are really needed to move the needle.
Mm-hmm.
And then also to make some assessment of where those resources should go to move the needle, right? It's not spread it so thin that it's ineffective. It's here are 25 or here's 10 important. And we have a project we're doing in Rochester, New York, where we defined 25, we call them high impact vital enterprises that are owned by Black-owned business. And we targeted our advisory services, and we're targeting some of the impact capital directly to keeping those 25. That means now we're being selective. There's, mm-hmm. 280 others, but these people we defined as they're on an important commercial corridor. They employ locally. They serve in Little League baseball team. They involve civically. They have a needed product or service. Them closing, because we invested in them in the last year or two, will, stymie our further economic development efforts a year or two from now when we can go back to more traditional, business attraction work, right? So, this is almost targeted business retention in a way that that can be done. So that type of stuff, being able to figure out how to do that and to do that in a way that you can explain it. It doesn't seem like we're, choosing winners and losers, so to speak, to identify where in the corridor do you start, right? Mm-hmm. What neighborhoods are on the cusp of change? Sometimes the cusp means going up and people quickly start fearing gentrification, but often the cusp may mean stemming decline, that if we don't do something here, it's going to set us back. So all of that to say, trusted partners, local stakeholders, I probably didn't mention elected officials, but they have obviously have constituencies and viewpoints, some of the nonprofit and community organizations, longstanding leaders operating with limited resources, but doing the good Lord's work to, keep community development stuff happening. This is really a time where community development and economic development, and corporate and philanthropic support and government really need to be all singing from the same sheet of music.
Yeah, I love that, singing from the same sheet of music. So I know you at Rutgers, I know you're like able to just kind of be laser focused and do this work. I already know the question that's going to be coming out of the listeners, and it's going to be, is there capacity through your office to help other communities, or are you really focused on the community there around Rutgers, or what does, like, if somebody wanted to call and get some consultation with you or to hire you for a study, like, do you have that capacity to help others?
Absolutely. So we're definitely available. I didn't necessarily come on the podcast to sell services, but we're absolutely available. Typically, our work is supported by big philanthropy in the community. Mm-hmm. We've not sought government sort of support. Because what you're doing, our work is we're walking that line where we're saying that doesn't work, where we can make hard decisions, put resources here, not here, in a way that, my experience in traditional, when I led our economic development organization, I realized how political it was, right? I had to make sure I sort of covered all bases. So our work has typically been, can we find philanthropy, local banks, local foundations, maybe some federal, we've got some federal grant resources as well, CARES Act money in some instances, that then allowed us to do the advisory services, to, provide the additional survey and data gathering, to do just the neighborhood stakeholder coalition building. Of late, we've been spending some really good work, which I'm most excited about now, of helping drive inclusive ownership of real estate in commercial corridors, right? I have a elevator speech now where I say wealth is created by, owning assets, mm-hmm. generate recurring revenue or appreciate over time. So if we're talking about racial wealth gap closing and systemic change, we got to help more people own assets that generate revenue and have the potential to appreciate over time. So putting together structures and knitting together deals and finding the resources and changing underwriting criteria that drives inclusive ownership, something we're really excited about. I'm spending a lot of time also on what I call next economy entrepreneurship and economic development. So not just the, and not turning our nose up at the coffee shop or the boutique, but thinking about what are growth sectors, what are growth industries, and how do we connect people who traditionally haven't participated? How do we position people of color to lead and drive that growth, right? And identifying the sector, right? You know, you can quickly go down and say, whatever it is, autonomous vehicles, cannabis, solar energy, ARVR, healthcare. You know, you can go down and say, these are growth sectors, fintech. You know, can you position drones? Can you position people who normally wouldn't think I can be in those industries, either find a little niche to be adjacent somehow to that growth, but to participate in growth and to drive it as opposed to, being adversely impacted by it.
Yeah. That as you were talking, I started thinking about one of the other issues, and this is going completely off the script. So I'm sorry. We're just in conversation with each other now. I apologize. Yeah. But one of the other issues that I know a lot of economic development leaders have been talking about recently has been the lack of really minority candidates in economic development.
Sure.
And in the fear that maybe people don't realize that being in economic or even community development is a viable career path. It's just one of those things. I mean, we all landed here how we landed. There's very few people that, woke up one day and was like, you know what, I'm going to go to school to be an economic developer. Sure. But what are your thoughts on how to recruit more people of color, especially to want to explore economic development? And what advice would you have for maybe the people who are, really, really able to have internship programs and those types of things for economic development in order for them to have more minority candidates in those positions?
So there's an old movie that I love. The movie was called Love and Basketball.
Oh my gosh, I love that movie.
There's a question in the movie and it said, do you remember when you fell in love with hip hop, right? And people would tell their story. So, I fell in love with economic development because it's law, it's finance, it's politics, it's manufacturing, it's marketing, promotion, events. And I think if we want to drive more, diversity and inclusion in our industry, we have to think about, any of those sectors. And so we have to think about how do we get more people of color who have any of those expertise to just participate in some of the economic development initiatives, to volunteer on economic development committees, right? So that people get a taste and say, oh, here's a way I can use my marketing background. Here's an alternative way I can use my legal or accounting background. Because what I'm finding more, and I'm sure this is an international trend, is people want meaning in their work, more meaning in their work. And almost everybody I know who has a long career in economic development feels that meaning in the work. That's why we stick in and stay in the work. That's, economic developers, they may go place to place, but they keep that connection to that work because it's such meaningful work. And so I think early on, there's an opportunity to do outreach at the entry level, startup sort of economic development. But where I think there's an even greater opportunity is people who are in mid-level careers in corporate, in government, in nonprofit leadership, in community, more community-oriented development, to just be invited into the economic development tent. I think we should do that more. Economic development organizations in government can do that more by asking people to volunteer, giving people to be on task force and committees, and getting people just to come into the local economic development office. Right. I remember when I headed IEDC, they'd say, the EDC doesn't help me. And I was like, well, why don't you come see me? And they were critical of our work. But once they came and sat in our office and said, well, how can we be helpful to you? What are you working on that I can add value to or support? So it's on our job as leaders, mid-level leaders, board members, to find ways to invite people in, just to almost have an appetizer, sample the work that we do, see the connection and the passion work that, you know, the passion that we all feel, and then to then be able to respond to openings, job postings. We'll see more diversity in our space.
I think you're right. I think we need to give them a little bit of an insight so that they can kind of get bitten by the same bug that we all got bitten by. Absolutely. You know, that you don't even know what it is until all of a sudden you're doing it and you're loving it and you can't imagine doing anything else. So speaking of you and your kind of career and your leadership, I can tell just by our even, you know, 15 minute interaction so far, that you are a man of energy. Like you have a lot of energy and you're just extremely, extremely excited about what you're doing. How do you maintain your energy as a leader? Like this year has been hard for a lot of people. And I love how you articulated that. Yes, it's been hard, but it also is really given us an opportunity to really spotlight something and, you know, really bring a lot of energy behind something that has been happening for years, but now there's kind of a place that we can really, really shed a spotlight on it. How are you waking up each day as a leader, you know, really making sure that your battery is charged and ready for this work? Like, how are you taking care of yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is, you know, there's urgency to our work right now in a different way than it was a year ago. Right. Mm-hmm. And so there's inspiration to the work. And, you know, when it's time to, you know, work hard, you work hard. What's been fascinating for me this year is, like everybody else, since March 3rd, you know, I haven't traveled much at all. Literally, I'm on Zoom calls from, you know, 8 a.m. to 7 or 8 p.m. Right. And I was just telling my wife, you know, just earlier today. Now I'm going to start scheduling a lunch hour, right? I'm just eating through meetings and, you know, darkening the screen and, you know, munching on my sandwich in between calls, right? However, it hasn't been to the last month or so that it started to feel like a grind, right? Mm-hmm. It really has been, because all of the stuff that I've always wanted to work on, how do I get more resources to underserved areas? How do I strengthen Black entrepreneurs? How do I structure new investment vehicles to get capital to communities that have been underserved? How do I directly even propose systemic change in underwriting, in evaluation, in, you know, procurement? Now you can put all those things out there. So I'm getting energy from that work. It's been a remarkably productive year in that respect, because most people that I want to talk to, we can get them on a Zoom call. You know, you don't have to wait to meet, and, you know, meeting by Zoom now is not a discount, like, oh, we're going to meet virtually. So, you know, it's been very impactful work. Truth be told, though, I am about ready for a vacation. So I'm looking forward to some downtime around the holiday.
Yeah, taking the holidays to kind of read.
We got to make hay when it's time to make hay, right?
And
This is the work, and we're needed. And, you know, hopefully years from now, we'll look back and say, we did some good things then, and the world got better in the midst of all of the, you know, the pain of the pandemic.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I know that the work that you're doing is going to make things better. I have no doubt, because you're doing incredible things, and you're doing it with your heart in the right place. I can tell that. And so I just am so appreciative that you skipped your lunch hour today so that you could be with us. So that we could learn from you and feature you on the America's Jobs team. Thank you so much for your insights, for your expertise, and your willingness to kind of answer hard questions. And we hope that we will connect with you sometime soon here in the near future. But you were just a pleasure to have on the podcast today. And I just really appreciate your everything that you brought today, including that Energizer Bunny attitude and your smile and everything. So thank you so much for being
with us. Thank you so much for having me. I really, really enjoyed it. And keep hope alive.
Absolutely. I love that. All right. Well, it is as simple as that. Thank you so much for everything that you mentioned. It's certainly so near and dear to my heart. My husband is also, he's a Black entrepreneur.
Yes, yes.
I'm here in Kalamazoo, Michigan, just trying to keep his business afloat through COVID. He owns a small fitness boutique. And he's a medical massage therapist.
Yes.
And so here in Michigan, there's been a lot of restrictions. So he's been home taking care of the kids most of the year.
I get it. What's the, I used to come to Kalamazoo. There is a great bed and breakfast. Oh, I can't think of that.
Is it the Henderson Castle?
Yes, which is unbelievable. I love that place.
Yeah. They have a new owner in the past, like, I think he's been there for like 3 or 4 years, but he's French. And he is like their chef and pastry chef. And it's like even more phenomenal than before because he's brought like a very French inspired experience to the cuisine. And it's really good.
That is such a, I lived in Chicago at the time, and I was dating a lady who lived in Detroit. And so that was like the halfway point.
Yep.
And we have, so I got good memories of Kalamazoo. Good food.
Yes.
Good, really fun place. Henderson Castle is exactly right.
Yep. So, yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. We appreciate it. And I'm sure that you're probably, I'll have to get from Faye. We'll follow up with you on when the podcast will air.
Yeah, I'll share.
Okay, because then I'm sure that people might reach out to you and ask you some questions about, just even for advice. We've had so many, we just had our economics conference last week, and one of the features was on a company. It's three guys who created, it's called Slim and Huskies. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a pizza company that started in Nashville.
All right.
But they've been growing, and they have an Atlanta location now and several others. But they were on there kind of telling their story of starting their business. It's three Black men who are best friends that started a pizza company. And since then, people have been like calling literally every day to say, like, how do we get a Slim and Huskies here? And I think people are really just trying to figure out how to support, especially Black business. And so I wouldn't be surprised, just to warn you in advance, good. That.
So tell me, give me 30 more seconds on America's Jobs Team. I don't know him. And then how many people listen to the podcast? 100 or 200, 1,000? What's the deal?
Well, we send it out each week to about 1,200 economic developers that have subscribed. I'd have to ask Faye exactly how many kind of listen to an episode.
Yeah.
But it started, so Consultant Connect is kind of the mother company. And so it's kind of an interesting story. So Consultant Connect started out of Southwest Michigan first, which is a local economic development company here in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Okay.
And we became pretty well known for our engagement with site consultants, especially for being like a smaller market. And so we ended up several, especially in Indiana, several Indiana communities that were similar in size to Kalamazoo wanted to hire us to connect them with site consultants and do like their events. So we started doing that, and it's just kind of grown. And then probably about, I think it's been 4 years, we started the America's Jobs Team podcast. And it started mostly featuring economic developers and then site consultants. And now we've just kind of, it changes focuses just to kind of keep leadership or, listeners up. But we always feature, every year we do an America's Top 50 Economic Developer kind of like competition. And we always feature them every year. But then we kind of put in different interviews over the course of time. But you can subscribe to it on
Apple
or whatever.
Yeah. Good deal.
Yep. So it's a good, we just did our Consultant Connect. We have a conference called Economics, and that was last week, and it was virtual. I'll send you a link. So it's kind of a blend between economic development content through site consultants, and then also like leadership inspired talk. So we had this year, we had John Gordon on there, Cor Schulze, who was the founder of the Ritz-Carlton, And he was kind of talking about customer service, and so there's just a kind of a variety of topics.
Yeah. Very cool. If I can be helpful in any way, please let me know.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. You were helpful by just being on the podcast and sharing your insights. It's very fascinating. You're doing great work.
Hey everyone, I'm here today with Steve Jast, who is the president and founder of Research on Investment and Gazelle AI. Hey Steve, it's great to speak with you today. As one of the leading voices in investment attraction and lead generation, what has stuck out the most for you over the past few months?
Hi Faye, thanks so much for the question. First and foremost, let me say that I love the content that Consultant Connect has been generating. I'd also like to take a second to wish all of our listeners continued good health. Every day is really a new adventure. We're seeing some sad stories of industries and companies in steep, unexpected decline, and we're also seeing areas of growth and opportunity. A couple of areas that have generated significant strategic discussion center around supply chain and reshoring. To help economic developers blend these into their strategic plans moving forward, we've been providing complementary data pools and access to our Gazelle AI platform.
That's really awesome, Steve. I'm sure this data has helped many economic development organizations. Can you explain how exactly Gazelle AI helps?
Sure. Yeah, great question, Faye. Our platform includes supply chain data for over 900 industries with related company listings. We also have complete company hierarchies, meaning users can build lists of companies that have an HQ in a specific state or country with manufacturing activities in other specific countries. This is ideal for economic recovery planning, reshoring business attraction strategies, understanding local supply chains, and overall investment attraction.
Wow, thanks, Steve. Hey, everyone, if you would like to activate your complimentary access to Gazelle AI, connect with Steve by emailing him at steve@gazelle.ai. That's steve@gazelle.ai. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Tune in again next week for more insight and relevant content to the issues impacting economic development today. America's Jobs Team podcast is sponsored by Research on Investment and Gazelle AI.